So I have two questions for Granite.
Yeah.
These are both selfish questions. They're the things I've been thinking through in my own work. We talk about a lot in the lab, and I feel like I've been coming up in media studies conversations, and to some degree in SDS. And the first one's the degree to which this work, you use the word efficiency or maybe inefficiency. So the degree to which this work is necessarily engaging accelerationism, and what I think is a kind of peculiar, I'll say curious moment where people like Galloway, Stephen Shabiro are kind of calling for necessary inefficiency, right? And this almost strikes me as a utopic move, right? So if that interests you, so is it necessary inefficiency and an appealing like slow computing or something like that, that which isn't productive in an age of heightened or incredible productivity and emphasis on making objects to be productive. And the other one is when in your work you might feel like, and I think I can get away with this because there aren't a lot of English back in here, but when reflection's overrated, like so that it's become such a part of the academic genre that, say, for example, many students I work with know how to rehearse it, right? They know what it sounds like. There's a language for it now. They've been taught it. And so...
You mean in talking about technology?
Yeah, technology, literary studies, critical theory, like they know what reflection, like, it is assumed it's a now a congealed discourse that can be taught and almost rehearsed.
Yeah.
And I worry sometimes that, I was thinking like going back to Donna Haraway's work, in particular her critique of reflection, and she goes to like diffraction, and she wants to talk about how difference is marked. So you work within the system in a kind of immanent critique to say, these are where differences are, and this is how I want to work within this model of diffraction, which isn't this outside model of reflection. Right, so I don't, that one's far more theoretical than the first, but yeah, necessary inefficiency and when reflection is overrated, if you feel like it is.
Well, for inefficiency, I mean, most of what I do is like sort of blatantly inefficient. Or making fun of efficiency.
Yeah.
And part of that is that my dad, being an engineer, everything is focused around efficiency, usually, or stability, predictability. And part of that is, just poking fun at that in my own kind of way, right? But, I mean, I don't mind the concept of, like, post-optimal. Post-optimal is kind of an interesting term because it's like for a lot of our artifacts, like our, this chair, it's been like engineered and it's been optimized and it's been, steel case or whoever makes it, it's like a mass commodity or for things that we can buy, it's at Walmart. And I mean, this is also like a very like privileged kind of like space to be able to say, oh, we're post-optimal now, because a huge chunk of the world is not. Of course, you have to understand that it is a very privileged kind of like London art school kind of like stance to take, but. But for a lot of Western culture, I mean, it's not a bad, the idea of a post-optimal object is, really valid. And you see it coming back in, artisanal cheese shops or craft brewing or all the Portlandish kind of stuff. I mean, it's you see the post-optimal thing taking form in wider culture, from cheese shops to chocolatiers to whatever. Handmade bikes, or whatever. Handmade bike seats. It's all kind of like post-optimal and not... I mean, it's also like efficiency. It's sort of like... It's not just that it's inefficient. It's like, who's it efficient for, It's always, it's always like a loaded question. It's like, is it efficient? Well, you can't really put that into an equation and just say that, oh, it's just efficient. Well, yeah, it's efficient, but in the meantime, you're causing, this like pollution or, it's much more complicated system. So you said necessary inefficiency.
Yeah, I think this should.
I think it's a wider sort of cultural thing. It's also, I mean, I see a lot of this interest in making stuff, whether it's like computer scientists or people in the humanities that are interested in this stuff. They've just sort of like had so much online screen-based stuff that you just give them a hunk of Play-Doh, and it's a really kind of curious, playful thing that I think a lot of students feel kind of removed from, you know, the tired of stuff being abstracted. So, and it's historical, like if you think of how objects really have a lot of weight to them, like, you know, the cast iron frying pan that my grandmother used to use, you know, that I have now, or the table that I got from them, or the rolling pin that my dad carved when he was 11, or whatever. I mean, all those things are like really, really important objects. And so I think that it's not just, I mean, so efficiency is only part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a complicated kind of term. And then the second part of the
reflection bit, yeah. So I don't know if you have like moments in your work where you're like, maybe reflection's not what I'm after, or this isn't quite reflection, it's something else.
I haven't thought about that. I mean, it's interesting because this is like an art school kind of thing. Is like, it's kind of like walking into a hackerspace,
mm-hmm.
where people are very busy using laser cutters and tools and carving things and painting stuff, and they're very, you know, action oriented. But then it's a step, you know, and that's kind of what a university does. It sort of steps back and go, okay, like, think about what you're doing and why. I mean, I'll have to think about that. I don't know. The refraction, I think it's a valid point. I'm not sure what to make of it, but... Yeah, reflection, I mean, I went through and did a PhD in humanities. And it sort of... And I can understand, like, the overemphasis of the reflection, where you have people who are writing about digital culture or something like this, and they've never, like, really programmed or something. It's like, if you were, like, studying food, if you were writing your dissertation on Baudrillard or whatever, you probably should know how to read French, right? But, if you're working with computers or social networking, you should probably have some field work experience in working with this stuff. If you want to think about, like, in a literary kind of way, like, yeah, of course you know how to use... I mean, it's kind of like media materialism, Kittler or whatever. So, yeah, reflection can be overrated in humanities, especially in humanities. Yeah.
Thanks for... I liked your four steps a lot. It seems really helpful. And it's like almost like a conceptual kit that I can open up and interested in working with that. At the same time, I feel like you have a fifth step. And that's what I'm interested in. When I saw the four steps, I thought, like, it's the four steps on their own is almost like a really interesting riff on surrealism in making, like, inverting my everyday, like, exposing the bizarre, the weird. And that inversion being like a critique. But I think your fifth step, like, it seems like the four steps you have there don't really speak to what you're doing. And the final step is not creating this new metaphor, this new inverted object, or how did you put it, the body, or the object embodies the inversion?
Yeah.
What I was interested in is how you, as a critical maker, like, we embody the inversion. Like, when you were driving the Sega cart, there was a moment where you looked around the screen, and I thought that, like, that kind of stuff was the really interesting part. And even, like, wearing the cell phone, not, I guess, the cell phone tent
Yeah.
It's funny. Like, I'm trying to think of someone who doesn't know what a cell phone is, and it's like, why are they putting a blanket over their head? Like, mm-hmm. why are they blinding themselves? It's like, so they can see. And it's like, it's that kind of negotiation that I'm really interested in your work. It's where it's where you play with it, where you like
how do you deploy it, kind of?
Yeah, and it seems to be that that's the point where, like, the Sega card thing is like almost a metaphor for me, where you have this prototype, but that prototype makes you look away from an object and look at your surroundings, and seems to open critique up.
Yeah, I mean, and it's true that often the deployment isn't really what. I mean, I say, you know, you build a thing, but often I take for granted, yeah, you put it into exhibitions, you show it to people, they write something about it, it circulates in different ways, but it definitely could be deployed a lot differently. And I mean, I guess that's kind of the weakness of me coming from studio art background, is that it's like, you know, you just kind of make the thing and then like, I don't know, but I mean, in that cockroach robot, people in mechanical engineering look at it and they say, you know, where's your data from your effectiveness of this like insect controller? And I'm like, well, I didn't really like test it out. Like, I have no data on it. So it's something that, I mean, it's interesting to think of. How is this thing deployed? I mean, one thing that I'm working on now with a guy, Will Odom, who's a postdoc at SFU in the CAP program. He's working with a guy, Ron Wakari, who does stuff with design. We're working on trying to put sort of this conceptually leaning work out as a commercially available kit, or as a kind of like, not quite a product, but thinking how you could distribute this stuff in maybe an interesting way that people, it kind of gets beyond like the gallery, or like just a demo, or it's effective to show the documentation, but then how do you disseminate this stuff? It is kind of a problem, like, or it's a challenge. So working on kind of like experimenting with that.
Also, like in terms of kind of related to deployment, I guess. One thing that I find really interesting in the examples you showed and what you were speaking about is sort of thinking about like how to, especially like to a broader audience or to any audience, I guess, like how to communicate a critique of an object in the made object. So if you're going through a process of critical making or something of the sort that you've described, so in some of the examples you gave, and I think you even mentioned mentioned satire as like an element in a lot of your work. A lot of projects like this, I think, often end up being a mix of functionality and satire or critique. So something like the phone tent, for example, which I think is a really fun and cool project. It's kind of like, well, in some ways it's a critique of these social or cultural habits and technologies,
sure.
Right?
Sure, yeah.
At the same time, it's like a functional tool to help you maintain those, while at the same time it's like critiquing it, and it's a satire of what we're doing and
the people
we're engaging in.
Yeah.
So then sharing these types of projects with people, I feel like there's always, or at least in some of the work that I do, I'm always like, well, this is supposed to be a critique of it, but what if people just really like it and it's functional to them?
Well, I mean, that's what scares a lot of people with that aren't familiar with building. Like, that's a scary thing about building an object.
Yeah.
It's legible and usable to a lot of people, but you don't know if somebody's going to take that and completely take it backwards.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have the precision that you do if you write something about it. They can take an object and be like, well, you know, you could say that this is, I don't know, this has a certain use, but you could find somebody that drills a hole through it and makes it into a pendant, or you can't really control a lot of what people do with objects. I mean, that's kind of the challenge. I mean, but sometimes the way that people take stuff and misappropriate it is interesting, and you can get something out of that too. But you definitely give, I mean, I found that people who have a background in humanities would just be very, very unnerved at the idea of building something and somebody misappropriating it or misunderstanding it. But it's, I mean, and that actually is what got me into doing this PhD in humanities, because I got sick of writers writing about my work and taking, misreading it. I mean, it can be done on a practical level, drilling a hole through it, or it can be done on like a, in a theoretical level where somebody sees a project and they're like, oh, this is about my, you know, academic fetish. Blah, 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 blah. Here, insert this image, talk about whatever that's sort of completely unrelated. And that's actually me getting upset about that. It's kind of like, damn it, I need to learn how to write. You know, I need to like work on this. Because I need to be able to articulate what I'm talking about, what I'm building. Yeah.
Patrick's point earlier about the way in which you're asking people to inhabit the inversion and what happens on the periphery is really interesting to me, because I don't think it's a mirror image of the center. Yeah, so when you bring the, if you're taking the to go back to your language, if you take the margins, put them in the center, you make an inversion out of that, you build an object that embodies the inversion. It seems to me that it's not a neat transfer. So there's something different happening there. And that moment where you looked, when you were turning, and I don't know how, you know, hyper aware you were of it, but you know, when you look outside to turn, I was like, what's happening?
I lost confidence.
Yeah.
Oh.
And how do you think
it's terrifying to drive? It's like a rolling lawsuit. It's so terrifying. And I'm not a very good programmer, and the people who are working with me weren't very good programmers as well. And it's like, we never implemented the ability to see or detect people. We did the roads fine. It sees roads well, so the software didn't allow you to see people. And so it's like, that's kind of a pretty important like lack of software to see people. Because when you're driving, it's like, you generally don't want to like run over toddlers and dogs or people. And I've only hit one person. They weren't very seriously injured. That's another story.
Does that point in your own project? Such a good point, because I thought it was that point in the art project in every case where it wasn't about critical making anymore. I thought it was really interesting was that you're involved in unmaking, actually. Because Sega, you unmake Sega by actually literally doing a road test the video game, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To find out certain critical occlusions, like can't see toggles and stuff like this.
Yeah.
Or you take an iPhone and you do the same thing to iPhone, you intensify it, and you actually materialize what happens with cell phones, suffocating culture. And basically, the blanket over your head is just a materialization of what's communicating.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, following on what you're saying, I mean, you could, instead of thinking about an inversion, you could also think of it as just, think of like McLuhan-esque language.
Yeah,
like just extension. Like that you're by extending the thing further, that really you're sort of inverting it by just taking the thing and just extending it beyond where it's normally taken. I guess that would be another way to, you know, another, instead of the four steps, it could be like take the thing, extend it to sort of the point of like ridiculousness, and you're going to end up making a satire, or you're going to end up inverting it almost.
Yeah, but the irony is that you're arriving back to questions of phantasmatic identification. Mm-hmm. Like in your comments and answering these questions, suddenly you're into the Oedipal relationship with your father and stuff, which I don't understand.
Yeah.
Oh, and I thought, well, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
What's happening with that?
Yeah.
I thought that was in the city. It's not an extension. It's actually, I don't know, it's intensive. It's really intensifying.
Yeah.
It becomes paradoxically as phantasmatic as the object you study in the first instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, you understand that of course, things feels like engineering aren't just about efficiency. You see how stuff is produced, and it's very kind of haphazard, very creative, very... there's like a studio component. I mean, it's all framed under a whole different kind of framework, but the actual production of this stuff, my dad worked in vehicle research and did these hyper fuel efficient things that looked like these saran wrap coffins, where it was like to see how efficient your vehicle could be. And he had like this car at Expo 86 and all this sort of stuff, and was involved in all this vehicle research. And it was all just hectic. It was just like mostly farm boys that were like hacksawing apart 10 speed bikes and like rigging up it's like advanced go-karting, you know? What was my point? This really is an extension. I mean, a different way to say would just be, you don't take the metaphor, you just run with a metaphor, and you just make it more, you know, you just really extend.
Yeah, extend. Like a cockroach. It's really genuinely, the feeling of it was of uncanniness.
Yeah.
Because you bring out animality and robotics, and then when people are describing their thinking about questions of enslavement, like, what's the cockroach feeling about all this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was really pretty interesting.
Yeah.
One other question. Yeah. Do you think that maker culture, let's just think about as you're describing, because you're reworking McClone's Tetra, so, and which is really such a good creative way. I think that's a bit of, it's like, I'm making, I would say. But are you on making maker culture? So as you were describing that, well, is maker culture a panic response, basically, to the increasingly abstract, phantasmagorical quality and magical quality? Contemporary technology by trying to find the real and finally put your fingers on something, like something really concrete.
Yeah.
And increasingly used to like, right? I was quite enamored of that, but increasingly I say, oh, I don't know about this. Because what's really happening with questions of power and questions of, is in fact whole bodies of consciousness and imagination are being absolutely native all the time. So it's this sort of, I can't think of the term for it. It's like almost like a trompe l'oeil or something. Is maker culture like a trompe l'oeil, sort of, you know, deflecting the eye from what's really going on?
Well, yeah, I mean, I really think of it as like a reaction against, or a novel rediscovery of physical objects as an outgrowth of sort of oversaturation of screen, digital sort of screen culture.
Yeah, you know, this powerful nostalgia for the physical and the materials.
Yeah, yeah. But for a lot of people, I mean, I find for a lot of students,
it's pervasive.
They, and it I mean, you could look at like Sennett, Richard Sennett, or whatever, Shop Class, Soulcraft, or other authors that look at, you know, or a lot of material, object-oriented ontology stuff. Physical stuff is like, I don't know, just for me, it has a lot of weight to it, and a lot of, it's sort of reconciling the digital culture stuff with, you know, me liking to cook, or make handmade pierogies, or doing like, you know, the physical stuff that you do and you enjoy, gardening or whatever. It's kind of bringing that together and, you know, having it intersect back into the digital stuff. And for a lot of people, like, that study computer science or electrical engineering, they don't touch, like, circuit boards, or they don't... It's been sort of abstracted into higher level computing languages or whatever. That, you know, a lot of electrical engineers never even work with circuit boards. And so, it's sort of like a point where this abstraction goes up and up until, like, a little part of it collapses, and people go like, hey, like, what is a microcontroller? Or, you know, like, and in a lot of ways, like, an Arduino is like a computer from the 1970s. Like, it's really like an old-fashioned computer in a lot of ways. Like, it's not that different from an Apple II, you know? It's really like a pretty unimpressive thing from a technical perspective, but it just that I mean, of course, it's easy to use and has internet that a community of users to benefit it, but it's not like it's some brand, it's kind of like an old school thing that's easier to use, but part of it is just saying, like, what's computing anyways? Like, what are we doing with it? And so for a lot of people, like, okay, I can make, like, a automatic watering system for my plants, you know? It's like, okay, well, an Arduino is a better computer for that than my PC or whatever.
So then, I think, in terms of the language of technology, which is always attentive to such things, what do you think the next phase of the history of computation will be when it begins to absorb this powerful, nostalgic longing for the physical object itself? I mean, it's absolutely always attentive to human desires. This is a really powerful, pervasive desire, not just with computing, it's just, you know, just read any media, and just there's this palpable longing for, like, real objects, real memories.
Yeah, or just, I mean, I also think of it as, like, people just getting tired of, like, the crap that they buy at Walmart or Superstore. Well, Superstore probably has a lot of artisanal stuff. But, like, you know, just kind of being tired of that stuff. It's like, they're everybody's closets and garages is full of stuff, and it's like, so what? I mean, what's more, what does it mean to have, like, a meaningful kind of, like, object or idea? I mean, for me, I tend to think of, you know, things that my grandparents had or things that are invested with more history or have more kind of, you know, patina on them historically.
Yeah, or what would be the act for a meaningful experience?
Seems like you have to talk about not just desire, but intimacy. I feel like that's part of it too. This, like, I was talking about this in my games class this morning. The students, a lot of them are prototyping couch games. Okay, they don't want to have anything to do with networks. They want games that bring people into the same space. And they're like, they used to do this. Games used to be, like, about being in the same place and staring at the screen and watching. And then they talked a lot about, like, shared mechanics. So watching how other people play games. And I was joking about, like, yeah, the person that jumps with the controller, right? Like, that's crucial. But it seems like part of it too is, it isn't just about nostalgia for, like, an analog culture. I feel like there's a desire for an intimacy that networks and algorithms don't necessarily afford.
Yeah.
And I don't think it needs to be reactionary. Sometimes I read it that way, but I don't...
No, I mean, this is what hackerspaces really, really understand very, very well.
Yeah.
Is it's fun to get together with other people that are just making things, informally kind of glancing at what they're doing, have a few drinks with them, have some food with them, hang out, see what they're working on, kind of the peer, informal peer face-to-face network that you might have in, like, a pub, small town pub, or, like, whatever. Like in Saskatoon, I'd go for beer on Fridays and there'd be, like, the poets and the sculptors and whatever, and it was like, yeah, it's kind of, like, nice. And being online is, like, good too in a different way, but I mean, a hackerspace is really the social component of that. I mean, it's often focused just around tools. It's like, you know, like big laser cutter, big, you know, 3D printer or whatever. But the thing that people really get out of that are the informal things where it's like, I'm working on this, you know, trying to make a glass. So it's like, well, I don't know how to do 3D. I know how to form glass, let's say, but I want to make it this weird shape, so I don't know a lot about 3D modeling, so it's like, do you know something about this? It's like, yeah, no, or you don't, but, you know, you do, and then you give feedback. It's like it works because it's sort of a lightweight infrastructure, you know, that a lot of universities have difficulty with, or industry has difficulty with.
Kind of tying in with that question, do you think that makerspaces or hacker communities can be conducive to elitism, kind of in the same way that, like, Walmart versus, you know, the artisanal cheeses?
And, of course.
And how would you respond to that if you're experienced, or if you have experienced it or witnessed it, like how do you, is that something that you embrace, or is there a way that you can try and create a space that's more welcoming and less, I guess, elitist?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of hacker spaces are incredibly elite, and they sort of like pride themselves in being elite.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you need to, you're not even allowed to go into the spaces. You need to know somebody, and you go through an informal, like, interview process to see if you're kind of cool enough. But they, I've heard that referred to as top hat and monocle kind of hacker spaces, that they're looking for the best kind of group of people to hang out there. That you can only hang out there if you're really cool. Some places are much more like open, and also like hacker spaces are very diverse. You know, you have some that are just focused on, you know, that are moms for the most part with kids, or I mean, there's overlap with craft and all this sort of stuff, but some that are focused on bio-based stuff, you know. So it's difficult to say, you know, one thing for all hacker spaces. But some are very elite, and some are in, you know, public libraries. And there's, I think it's all over the place. Generally, the hacker places that call themselves hacker spaces tend to be more elite and tend to be come out of a history of like lock picking, cracking in security systems and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Conferences like DEF CON and other hacker, like Julian Assange sort of like thing, or Anonymous or whatever, and or InfoSec, it's referred to as information security. And then the makerspaces are much more like post Make magazine, kid-friendly, accessibility, rated G. There's nothing illegal going on. And a lot of places like sort of like pride themselves in like, oh, we do lockpicking, because like, yeah, we're more elite and cool. But there's really not a lot of people doing like illegal stuff. But it's sort of like, yeah, I belong to the hacker space. It's like, I'm like really like hardcore. And the spaces play that up.
Yeah.
Because it's more alluring, you know?
Yeah.
It's like you're entering into sort of a secret society or something.
Yeah.
I was wondering with the time, if you could speak a bit also about, like, sort of this engagement with, like, I guess, like, these technologies or practices that are referred to, like DIY, Maker, Arduino, and things like that. Kind of what differences or similarities or overlaps you see between kind of hobbyist practitioners and artists, and then, I guess, like, scholars engaging with digital making. Well, like, it seems like the cultures around those, I don't know, like, in what ways you think that they're similar or very different in the ways people engage with them.
I see a lot of people, independent of their labels, being sort of amateurs.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's an amateur in something, you know. And I think the thing that's good that you can take away from a hacker space or maker or this, the thing that I think is useful for this like Make magazine stuff is this idea of like willingness to sort of like be embarrassed and try something and trying to figure it out. It's communicated in a way that's often like looks like it's written for a suburban dad to do on the weekend. Yeah, it's kind of like a throwback to Popular Mechanics magazine or something like that from the, you know, 50s or 60s. But one thing that's good out of that is that there's a lot of like instruction and assumes that you kind of like don't know much. Although at the same time, like with open source, anything related to open source, there's this like, there's a thing where it's like open source software is like open for everybody. Linux, open for everybody to understand and use, and it's free and it's great, it will liberate you. And meanwhile, it's like, how the hell do I use this? This is terrible. It's not usable. And it's even worse for open source hardware. It's like, there's so much technical knowledge and infrastructure that's known, it might as well just be a black box that you have no concept. So with open source hardware, I mean, I'm kind of getting off your going away question a bit, but there's really not that much difference, I think, in the way that artists approach this stuff or hobbyists from a technical perspective, but they're obviously having very, very different end goals of what they're trying to do, why they're trying to build the thing.
Garnet, thank you very much. This is fabulous. Your art is so interesting, and your reflections are incredible.
Thanks.
Yeah.
It's really great to be here.